Good morning. It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Keep your fingers crossed. Kathleen will be back on Monday. That's what we're hoping. Meeting with other NATO leaders, President Bush urged nations to commit more troops to Afghanistan, grant membership to Georgia and Ukraine, and continued to push for the missile defense system in Eastern Europe. That's what we're going to talk about this hour, Bush's last NATO summit. And you can help. Here are the numbers, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, please, if you're in Milwaukee. 800-486-8655 is a toll-free number. Good pretty much anywhere you can hear this program. 227-2050 in Milwaukee. If you'd like to use email, you can send us an email message to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Okay. My guest this morning to help us sort through the most recent NATO summit held in Romania is James M. Goldgeier, Whitney Shepherdson Senior Fellow for Transatlantic Relations at the Council on Foreign Relations and Professor of Political Science and International Politics at George Washington University. Good morning, Professor Goldgeier, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
There have been quite a few changes in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization over the years. It's grown a lot larger, for one thing, and its mission seemed to shift when the Soviet Union broke apart. And so there's been a real evolution of this alliance. How would you compare? I'd like to guess background this a little bit before we talk specifically about what happened this week at the summit. How would you compare the original NATO alliance in terms of its mission with the NATO of today?
Well, they are very different organizations, as you've just suggested. NATO, when it was established in 1949, an alliance at that time of the United States, Canada, and 10 West European countries, was designed to protect Western Europe from an attack by the Soviet Union. And for the next 40 years, the focus of NATO was on the possibility of tanks coming across from Eastern Europe into Western Europe. And then you had the collapse of the Soviet Union. And even in the 1990s, although NATO evolved in two significant ways, one starting to expand into Central and Eastern Europe, taking in first in the late 1990s Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, and then in 2004 taking in seven more members from Central and Eastern Europe. NATO expanded in terms of numbers, but even so, in the 1990s, it was still focused on Europe. It was doing different kinds of missions. It wasn't protecting anymore against the Soviet attack, but it was involved in the Balkans, first in Bosnia, and then in Kosovo. So it was still geared toward European missions. What we've seen in the last 5 years is NATO really moving out to significant other missions, most particularly the one in Afghanistan, where NATO has a significant number of troops and is trying to help the Afghan government create stability and to rebuild that country after the conflicts earlier in this decade.
The United States has been the largest military power in the alliance. Has that always translated into a dominance of the NATO alliance or not?
Yes, pretty much throughout NATO history, when the United States has wanted something, it's gotten its way. And that really is because of its position, both in terms of the kind of funding, but also as the major military power, and it really remains that major military power. It, for example, has the most troops in Afghanistan. That mission would not really be able to exist if it weren't for the United States. And again, the last decade in the Balkans, with the missions in Bosnia and Kosovo, the United States also had played the leading role. And that's why when we get into in a few minutes the discussion, particularly of this summit this week in Bucharest, having this major dispute between the United States and several of its allies is really rather unusual.
What is the source of the friction between the United States and its allies right now?
Well, the big source of friction at this summit was on the question of future NATO expansion in Europe. And that was the question of whether Ukraine and Georgia, two states that formerly were part of the Soviet Union, should be offered what's called a membership action plan. And this isn't actual membership, but it's a formal mechanism by which countries then meet with the NATO allies and go over what kinds of steps they have to take in order to become members down the road. And Ukraine and Georgia were hoping to get this membership action plan at this summit. The United States had pushed very hard for membership action plans for Ukraine and Georgia, and in that effort, the United States was supported by most of the new members of NATO from Central and Eastern Europe, but Germany and France refused to go along, largely out of the concern of the Russian reaction. And this is really the first time since the end of the Cold War that we've seen Russia really be able to shape the internal deliberations within NATO.
Well, let's talk about Russia for a moment. I mean, historically, there's been a certain level of, and I'm going to use this word with a small p, not a capital P, a certain level of paranoia that's part of the Russian psyche when it comes to foreign relations. And in their case, sometimes people really were out to get them. It's my understanding, for example, the former Warsaw Pact, when the communists took control of those nations. Part of that was Russian foreign policy or Soviet foreign policy to establish a buffer zone against the West because they were concerned, rightly or wrongly, about an attack coming from that direction. Why was President Bush pushing so hard for Georgia and the Ukraine to be members of NATO when he had to know that the Russians would perceive this, rightly or wrongly, as a direct threat to them?
Well, it's a complex situation in Europe, and there are several different issues at stake. And so, of course, one of them is this issue of Russian sensitivity. The problem is, as you say, in the aftermath of World War II, the Soviet Union decided, having had the experience it had with the German invasion, that it was going to try to extend the territory between it and Germany and use these countries of Central and Eastern Europe as a buffer zone. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of a new Europe, certainly a new Germany in the decades after World War II, those issues were much less salient, although you still had that historical Russian concern. And you also had, I think, a little more ominously, this notion by Russia that it should be able to control the affairs of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe that had been in what they considered their sphere of influence. But after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, these countries in Central Europe, countries such as Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Latvia, Estonia, and others, they were independent countries, and they wanted to choose a future within the West. So from the NATO standpoint, and especially from the United States standpoint looking out, there was the thought that, well, these countries, if they want to be part of the West, they should be given that opportunity. The original NATO Treaty of 1949 says that NATO is open to any European country that can meet the criteria and further the principles of the alliance and contribute to alliance security. And so there has been this notion by NATO that countries that in Europe that can do that should be allowed that opportunity, that Russia should not have a veto by virtue of the fact that it used to control the policies of those countries, and that NATO also takes the view that it's not a threat to Russia because there's no one in NATO who's thinking that NATO is somehow going to be attacking Russia. So even though there is sensitivity to Russian concerns and an understanding that Russia is unhappy, there is this other competing principle that these countries should have the right to pursue the relations they want with the West. And that's why the Bush administration, which has pursued this you know, democracy agenda, especially in the second term, is trying to help countries like Ukraine and Georgia on this path.
When the Soviet Union broke up, when the Berlin Wall came down, the Eastern Bloc split apart, the popular assumption was that, well, you know, Russia is basically done as a major power in the world, and you know, that's just over, and we don't have to worry about it again. We can go ahead and beat our swords into plowshares and so forth, because that's it. We don't have to worry about an east-west conflict of the kind that we were looking at up until the 80s. Russia has really come back, and they're a very powerful nation, and they're starting to really assert themselves. How does that change the way NATO has to look at its own policies in Europe?
Well, I think the biggest effect that the Russian resurgence has had is on the policy of countries such as Germany. And also France to a lesser extent, but France as well. And that is countries that are in Europe, you know, especially for Germany in the middle of Europe, it's a lot closer to Russia than we are, at least in that direction. And so there is this sense that they need to, from the German sense, need to be more accommodating. You know, the danger there is feeding into those old Russian imperial notions. You know, there was a hope after the Cold War was over, and I would amend slightly, yes, there was this sense, not that Russia was no longer a great power, but that Russia was no longer a power that was naturally predisposed to conflict with the West. So whatever Russia might become, the hope was that it would move to become more democratic and market-oriented, and it would still be a major country, but it wouldn't necessarily be in conflict with the West. And what we've seen in the last few years is a Russia that's much less democratic, and, you know, is more openly competitive with the West. It's certainly not looking to integrate into the West as some hoped in the early 1990s, in the West anyway, and some in Russia as well. So you do have a very different dynamic, and Russia under President Putin has sought to play a much more important role on the world stage and try to use what's the one lever they have now, which is the Russia's role as an energy provider and the high price now of oil and gas, which has helped Russia considerably. They're still on a lot of other dimensions. I mean, for example, military power, this is not the country that the Soviet Union was during the Cold War.
Well, you mentioned gas. Natural gas is something that that Russia exports into a lot of European countries, and I'm going to assume that there's some sensitivity toward whether or not they would restrict that flow if they were upset enough about something. Although then they don't get the money either. It's kind of a two-edged sword. But since Russia has the hand on the tap, doesn't that give them some extra influence?
Well, it certainly gives them perceived influence in Europe. But you hit the nail on the head. It's a two-edged sword. I mean, if they decide they want to cut off the supplies to Europe, then they have a problem because they're not getting the income that's been so important to their recent rise. So I think while Europeans are naturally nervous about their dependence on Russia, and I do believe that feeds into their overall attitude, at least for many in Western Europe, that they need to be more accommodating to Russia, there is a limit to the Russian leverage, and that is, as you've identified, the fact that this is how they earn a significant amount of their money.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll see if people want to join us on the phone or through email. Here are your numbers, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 227-2050, 414-227-2050. For shy persons who haven't had their powder milk biscuits yet today, you can use our email address. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 after 9, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. We hope that Kathleen will return to the microphone on Monday morning. Later on today on the Ideas Network, after 1 on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, the latest news from the microscopic world, from viruses that can cure diseases to bacteria that use antibiotics as food. Talk of the Nation Science Friday after 1 o'clock today on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about foreign policy, United States foreign policy, and specifically President Bush's last NATO summit, which just ended today in Bucharest, Romania. And I have to say that it's just odd to say that a NATO summit is taking place in Bucharest, Romania, having been someone who grew up during the height of the Cold War. My guest to help us discuss what has gone on this week in Bucharest is James Goldgeier, Whitney Shepherdson Senior Fellow for Transatlantic Relations of the Council on Foreign Relations and Professor of Political Science and International Politics at George Washington University. Well, Professor, I want to move into talking specifically about the summit. For the rest of the program, and there's been the talk in the media. It's these kinds of summits now are covered almost like sports events about who won and who lost, or like political campaigns, and who has what influence and so forth. You kind of follow it like a soccer match or something. There were a number of major issues that were on President Bush's agenda. So why don't we go through them and see kind of, you know, how he did and who the players were and why things came out the way they did. We alluded earlier to President Bush wanted the action plans established for Ukraine and Georgia to put them on the glide path toward admission to the NATO alliance, and that one he failed, and that was largely because of the opposition of France and Germany. So you know, we've discussed that, and we can come back to it if there's more to say about that. But there were some other issues. Let's talk about the missile shield. That's been something that the United States has been pressing for a number of years. And it seemed to me, and maybe I'd misunderstood the news story, but it seemed to me that the United States got its way on this.
Yes, the United States did. And I think there are a lot of people wondering if there was a deal involved since Bush wasn't getting what he wanted on Ukraine and Georgia to be able to get what he wanted on missile defense. And I think this was very important for the president, especially as he goes into his weekend meeting with President Putin in Sochi. Because that will be a major topic between the two leaders. And to have the NATO alliance formally behind this plan for a very limited missile defense, but deployments of a radar in the Czech Republic and 10 interceptors in Poland that are designed to protect against a potential missile threat from the broader Middle East, from Iran in particular, this was very significant for President Bush at the summit.
Well, here again, you know, this seems to me, and perhaps anyone who may have at one time studied European history, placing a defense system in Poland, regardless of what it's pointed at, seems like a rather provocative thing.
Well, it's so small, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with the kind of arsenal that Russia has. An arsenal that, frankly, isn't really that usable anyway. Nobody's really talking about Russia's using nuclear weapons. Certainly, Russia has reacted badly to this. I think it's part of the larger problem for Russia that it sees these moves in areas that were formerly part of its sphere of influence as humiliating to them, as, you know, a sign of Western power. On the other hand, the United States has tried very hard to reach out to Russia and seek Russia's inclusion in this missile defense program. The Russians, in response to the initial effort to pursue this missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic, had responded last year by saying they'd like to offer up instead a radar system in Azerbaijan that they felt could be useful in this. And what they were hoping is that could be a system that would make the deployments in Poland and Czech Republic not necessary. The U.S. response has been to welcome that Russian offer of the radar in Azerbaijan to say, not instead of Poland and Czech, but as part of a larger system. And NATO has made very clear this week that it would like to see Russia as part of this system. And we'll see what happens this weekend in Sochi. There's a lot of thought that since President Bush did agree to go, that there must have been something worked out ahead of time that it would at least allow them to make the case that they have a framework for discussion. And there's been some reports that what the West is offering to Russia, or may be offering to Russia, is the ability of Russia to have monitors at these sites in Poland and the Czech Republic to reduce their concerns.
I want to go back to the Ukraine-Georgia thing for just a moment, because I was recalling, on my way into work this morning, I was listening to NPR News, and there was a story about the spirited opposition that Prime Minister Merkel had to the Ukraine-Georgia initiative. And this kind of it surprised me a little bit, because Prime Minister Merkel has been portrayed as being a conservative and very much in tune with President Bush. I understand that the dinner meeting that went two hours longer than it was originally scheduled had some rather frank and confrontational exchanges between Germany and the United States. Was this a surprise to you as well? And is there anything we should read into this?
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't a surprise just because of the nature of the discussion over the last several months. But I think we should be disturbed by the very public split, the disputes between the United States and Germany, now stretching back several months. This started really after the new year with growing concerns by the United States that Germany wasn't doing enough in Afghanistan. Germany's very limited in what it can do in terms of where it can deploy its troops and what those troops are able to do in Afghanistan. Basically, they're not allowed to go into any dangerous areas, do any real fighting, go off their base at night. They're not allowed to be too far from a hospital. So they're very strict limits, and the United States has been pushing the Germans, and publicly Secretary Rice and Secretary Gates really articulated frustration on the United States side with Germany about this. And the Germans came back and said, and also very frustrated from their side, look, you don't understand our domestic politics. This is what we're doing in Afghanistan is important. It's very difficult for Germany to do more. So we really started to see, especially in February, that dispute really flare up. And then you had the United States pushing for Ukraine and Georgia to get these membership action plans. The Germans very publicly said early in March they would not support this. And so you did in the run-up to the summit have on these issues this very public split between the United States and Germany, which I think is very disturbing for the alliance. I would say that in terms of Chancellor Merkel's positions on this, largely reflect her own domestic politics, and she does have this coalition government. She also has to be concerned about the German public's own reaction to the conflict in Afghanistan. So she has a lot to deal with domestically there.
We are starting to get some phone calls and emails, and I want to get to an email here, because I think this is, goes right to the point that one of the earlier points that we were making, and it maybe gives us a chance to discuss it further. This is from Michael in Phoenix, Arizona. He writes, I have to wonder how much of the administration's willingness to poke the bear can be traced to the fact that Condoleezza Rice is a Soviet scholar. Her worldview was shaped by the Cold War and the U.S. struggle against the Soviets. Riling the Russians and reigniting Cold War tensions would put Rice back on familiar ground, where she might be more comfortable acting to press American interests as she learned them back in the day.
Well, certainly she does have an expertise in that part of the world. I don't think She's looking to rile up the bear. I don't think the administration's looking to rile up the bear. You know, George Bush, in fact, has been criticized for being too close to Russian President Putin. You may recall he famously, in June of 2001, after their first meeting, said that he looked into Putin's soul and liked what he saw. And he reiterated in advance of his meetings this weekend with Putin in Russia that you know, the two leaders like one another. And I think Bush has gone out of his way to try to have as good a relationship as he can with President Putin. As I said before, there are these competing principles at stake, and it has been, ever since the end of the Cold War, very difficult for the United States and its allies in Europe to manage these different sets of issues, wanting to make sure that the West had a good relationship with Russia, but also not wanting to limit the abilities of these newly independent countries in Central and Eastern Europe to pursue the kinds of futures that they want to pursue, and not allowing Russia to dictate what those policies are going to be. So it's been a very difficult balancing act, and certainly President Bush knew that by pushing these membership action plans for Ukraine and Georgia, that he was going to anger Russia, just as he's, you know, understood that Russia doesn't like the missile defense. But on the missile defense, he's really been trying to reach out to the Russians. But on the other issue, I think it's really a question of difficult competing priorities, and I don't think anybody's looking to rile up the Russian bear.
Let's take a phone call next from Betsy in River Falls. Betsy, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning. I've been paying pretty close attention to the politics of this here now world, and I've listened to this subject often, but I don't know who we are doing a missile defense against. Who's this aimed at, or how many is it aimed at?
Well, this particular system that would be deployed in Poland and the Czech Republic is, as this administration has argued, geared specifically against Iran, and the concern the administration has that Iran would be able to develop a capability that would in the future be able to threaten not only Europe but the United States. They've also pursued a system in Alaska that would be geared against the North Koreans. Now, you know, there's sort of two sets of issues here. One is, what do you really think is the likelihood of the threats coming from these kinds of countries? And, you know, what should the response be to that threat? The second is whether or not these systems are really able to work. One of the biggest issues with missile defense has been that the technology has not proven particularly effective. There was some thought with the recent shootdown of the satellite that the United States was showing that it really could do this, but I think we're really quite far away from having the technology available to have an effective missile defense. But I think that also should be part of this debate as we think about these kinds of deployments.
Well, shooting at a satellite is quite a bit different than shooting at a missile, which is moving quite a bit faster than any satellite travels. So you've got a lot of issues there.
Right, and you may have, you know, multiple missiles and also efforts to throw up decoys. Now, missile defense is very difficult, and a lot of money has been spent on this.
Okay, let's go next to Adrian in Milwaukee. Adrian, good morning. Thanks
good morning,
for calling.
Good morning. I was listening to the guy you have there in the radio, and I respect the fact that he seems very profound and intelligent on these issues. I think that the biggest issue, the main issue, is the credibility of the United States of America. The United States of America, in my opinion, has shown time and time again that there may be one thing that's standing on the surface, but behind the surface, something always seems to come up. With respect to this pushing this missile defense and so forth, things like that, I think it's equivalent of putting, asking somebody to be what you call Russia's sphere of influence, asking somebody to have, you know, that much more technological capability right in their backyard. And so when, you know, I think the issue is that the Russians are actually questioning, you know, whether or not this is smoke and mirrors. And then, you know, for example, if you have, for example, you speak about Iran, you know, they talk about, you know, I don't want to get you far off the subject, I know I only got a little time. Talk about Iran, they talk about the Iranians are, you know, assisting with IEDs over in Iraq, and they said Syria. Well, I think that's true. I think that's true, and the reason why I think it's true because, you know, why would everybody knows that the United States of America is in Iraq? So, if you look at it from Iran's perspective or Syria's perspective, if you have the United States of America, who's been in Germany over 50 years, who's been in Japan over 50 years, if the United States of America established themselves in Iraq, they might be there for 50 years. So it's not in the national interest of Iran or Syria to allow the United States to be there. The same reason why it's not in the interest of Russia to allow the United States to put a missile defense system in their backyard.
Well, I appreciate the question. There's, you know, two very interesting points, and I think there's no question that the United States and its NATO allies understand that Russia's not happy about the missile defense, and I think that's why they have been trying to seek Russia's participation in this system. Basically, the argument from the United States and its allies has been, you know, Russia is also in danger of any kind of ballistic missile threat that might be coming from Iran, and Russia has shown through its participation in UN sanctions on Iran that it is concerned about the potential of an Iranian threat. It is the case, as you've just mentioned in your call, that what Russia fears is not so much this limited deployment that's been announced for Poland and the Czech Republic, but that it could be used to build up something much larger. And I think the United States has been trying to address Russian concerns. Secretary Gates, for example, has talked about not making the system operational in any way unless and until there really is a threat from Iran. And your second point was on Iran and how it views its own security and its concern about the United States' position in Iraq and how long that might be. And I think, you know, the answer there is that the only real solution to that region, you also mentioned Syria, the only real solution, long-term solution, is for some kind of broader regional framework that the United States would be involved in that would address the security concerns that the United States has, but also that these countries in the region also have, because unless you can really ensure that everyone in the region feels more secure, you're going to have these conflicts arise.
Adrian, thanks for that call. I'm going to share an email from David in Fox Lake, who says, isn't NATO a military organization dominated by the United States? Hasn't the United States and NATO invaded more countries and deposed more leaders of countries in the past 50 years than any other entity? If this is true, shouldn't Russia and all countries of the world outside the alliance be concerned with its growth and increase in world dominance?
Well, in fact, NATO's military actions as an alliance have been very few. It's the first time it actually used force as an alliance was with its airstrikes in 1995 in order to try to stop the Serb actions regarding Bosnia and an effort to then end that war in Bosnia, which happened late in 1995. The first time it really went to war was over Kosovo in 1999. And then you had the NATO deployments in 2003 to take over the missions in Afghanistan in order to try to help with stability and reconstruction in Afghanistan. So NATO, yes, NATO is a military alliance. In fact, hasn't, as an alliance, used force, even though certainly member countries have used force, as we know. But what's really happening is that NATO is really facing fundamental decisions, and that really was not addressed at the summit, on its future and, you know, is it going to be doing more missions such as the one in Afghanistan? How does it see itself in this world in which it's not geared toward a threat coming from within Europe? It's not It doesn't need to worry about Russian attacks. Where else might it act beyond Afghanistan? I think those are all very important questions. Those are important questions for the public to be involved in within the NATO countries, including within the United States. And that's something that we really haven't seen yet, and something that will be important, especially as NATO approaches its 60th anniversary summit, which will be held next April.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take some more phone calls and emails. Here are your phone numbers, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you, so please call 414-227-2050, 227-2050. If you prefer to send an email, here's the address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up next hour, and it should be an interesting program, so be sure to stay tuned. During the Great Depression, FDR's New Deal gave 200 struggling Midwestern families a chance to relocate and farm the land in Alaska. That's right, Alaska. We'll be talking about a new documentary that chronicles this epic resettlement. That's after 10. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, a little farther afield, is where we're looking, specifically to Europe and the NATO alliance and the just concluded summit that was held in Bucharest, Romania. And we're talking about how President Bush did in this one. And one issue we haven't mentioned yet is an issue that the United States, I think, sort of got a win on, which is the admission of Croatia and Albania to the alliance. At least the alliance agreed to extend membership to Croatia and Albania. They rejected, however, a membership request by Macedonia, which is something the United States had been backing, and that didn't make the Macedonians too happy. But my understanding is that the rejection of Macedonia was based on Greek opposition to that admission.
Right, and I think actually if you put this together with the Ukraine and Georgia situation, the result of this week's summit is a little disturbing for NATO on the enlargement question. And again, enlargement is something that basically was written into the 1949 treaty, and we had several during the Cold War, but then we've had, you know, quite a few. We've had 10 new ones before this week in the post-Cold War, and now pending the ratifications in the domestic parliaments, including the United States Senate. You have Albania and Croatia that will be joining the alliance. Macedonia did everything that it needed to do to join the alliance. It met all the criteria. It should have been included in this. Greece objects to the name that Macedonia uses for its country. There is a province in Greece that shares its name, and the Greeks don't like Macedonia having Macedonia, the Republic of Macedonia, is the name. And Greece has held up Macedonian membership. And really, this is, you know, I mean, it shouldn't be part of this debate. Macedonia was told what it needed to do to be a member, and it did those things. It's unfortunate that it wasn't included in this group. What the NATO communique said was that NATO hopes that a mutually acceptable compromise can be worked out as soon as possible on the name issue, and once that is done, that then Macedonia will be invited to join. But so you had that issue, and then just going back for a minute to Ukraine and Georgia, again, what the Bush administration had hoped to offer was a membership action plan, and a country has to fulfill that plan in order to then have met the criteria to be a member. So NATO rejected that, but NATO also in its communique said that these two countries will become members of NATO someday, which seems at odds with the decision not to offer them the membership action plan. And also, you're supposed to actually fulfill all the criteria before NATO then makes a judgment about whether you can become a member or not. So I think NATO did a lot of damage to itself this week on this whole question of what it takes to become a member of the alliance.
Well, and on the Ukraine-Georgia issue, they agreed to take it up again, I think, next December. And in the Russian press, it's kind of interesting reading some of getting their viewpoint on this. Their contention is that they don't believe that the Ukraine or Georgia would ever be able to do what NATO wants them to do in order to become members anyway.
Yeah, I think this would be a very long-term process. Both countries, you know, have taken some steps, but there are many left to go. I think there are a number of NATO countries that are concerned about the significant opposition in Ukraine that exists, particularly in some parts of the country, to this step. Georgia has issues with respect to conflicts, secessionist conflicts occurring on its territory. So this would be a long-term process in any event. You mentioned December. December, there will be a meeting of the foreign ministers of NATO, and it's been agreed that if Ukraine and Georgia have made enough progress that they could then, the foreign ministers could make the decision to include Georgia and Ukraine in a membership action plan. That was in there because the Bush administration is still hoping that it can have this before President Bush leaves office next January. You know, he would like to do this. He doesn't want a successor to get the credit for it. He'd like to get the credit for it as part of his own legacy. So that's out there as a possibility for December. But already we've seen several of the allies, including Germany and France, say that they do not expect Ukraine and Georgia to be ready by December. So I think the Bush administration will try once again, but they have a long way to go before they get it done.
In the European press, this summit is being portrayed somewhat as a defeat for the Bush administration, and they have a different viewpoint on it, certainly than our domestic press in the United States does. It's always interesting to read and thank God for the internet. It's always interesting to read some of the European reactions to some of these, and they're quite a bit different than the way we look at things here in the United States. But from your perspective, as an expert in this area, how did the Bush administration do in this summit specifically? And then if we look back at the relationship of the Bush administration with its allies in Europe, maybe talk a little bit about how the administration has done with that alliance.
Well, I think actually in the summit, the Bush administration, I had very low expectations coming in on how they would do, and they actually exceeded those. They got the agreement on missile defense. There was the setback on Ukraine and Georgia, but that was known ahead of time because of the public opposition by Germany. It's an alliance that operates by consensus, so everybody's got to agree. So we knew that wasn't going to happen. Even so, the fact that there was this statement in the communique that Ukraine and Georgia will be members one day, which was hailed by the Georgian government as a historic breakthrough, I think that language was probably more than could have been expected. Also, you did have some commitment by Europeans to more troops in Afghanistan. Now, this is not as much as the Bush administration would hope, but France has announced that it will send 700 more troops. Poland and Romania also offered some more. There's also a clear indication by France that it will rejoin the integrated military command in NATO that it left 40 years ago. So, I think it was a mixed outcome. Again, as I said earlier, it doesn't really address the more fundamental problem of whether or not there's agreement within this alliance on what its purpose is and what it should be doing in the world, especially if it's going to be operating outside of Europe, given that its membership is simply a membership of the United States, Canada, and European countries. You know, what will give it the legitimacy to act in areas outside of Europe? On the broader question of NATO's relations, the U.S. relations with its allies in the Bush administration, you know, took a huge hit in 2003 with the split over the war in Iraq. The Bush administration has tried to repair those relations in the second term, but we've seen, for example, that leaders in Europe who've gotten close to the United States, such as Prime Minister Tony Blair, former Spanish leader José María Aznar, Berlusconi in Italy. It hasn't been good for your political health in Europe to get too close to the United States. We've seen, however, in France with the election of President Sarkozy, an effort to reach out more to the United States, certainly more than his predecessor Jacques Chirac had done. I think that we're still in a situation where the popularity of the United States is extraordinarily low within Europe, as it is in much of the rest of the world. And there's going to be a lot of work to do for whoever's the next president of the United States to try to reach out and rebuild and repair the relations with the Europeans.
Let's take some more phone calls as we start to get to the close of the program here. We'll take a call from Dan in White Lake, who's been patiently waiting. Dan, thanks for hanging on.
Good morning. Just a couple of points. Macedonia is insignificant and not worthy of comment. Number two, Russia is the Russia we created. We financed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, drove them out, in effect bankrupted the country. We should remember that although Russia is a lot larger geographically than we are, they have less than half of our population, therefore they have a much smaller tax base. Nothing has happened to create a greater shift of finances in the history of the world than the adverse impact of the war in Iraq. At the end of the Clinton administration, the price of oil was $18 a barrel. Now, Americans are financing the noose that will hang ourselves. Russia has now come out of bankruptcy on the strength of their oil revenues because they've got lots of oil, and on top of that, my gas bill, they sell gas to all of Europe and to the Ukraine, and my gas bill has gone up 100% since Bush went into office. We are committing suicide by the Bush administration, and there's no end in sight. Russia, Europe, since the fall of the Soviet Union, simply doesn't need us for their defense. A ground war in Europe is absolutely out of the question.
Well, I appreciate the call, and certainly the United States, through the war in Iraq, you know, the military has become overstretched. The war has cost an enormous amount of money. It's money that could have been used for other purposes, so there truly are huge costs to the war. I would disagree on two points. One, that the Europeans don't need us anymore. There are threats out there in the world, and I think we all need each other. I think that, you know, the United States and Russia, the United States and China, there are these threats that are coming from other parts of the world, and we need to work together to combat them. And my last point, I would take issue with your notion that the Macedonia issue doesn't need any comment. One of the things that the United States has been trying to do over the last decade with its European partners is to create more stability in the Balkans so we don't have a repeat of the 1990s. And this effort to bring some of those countries into NATO, also at the summit, NATO agreed to intensify dialogue with Bosnia and with Montenegro, and also tried to reach out to Serbia, and I think that's all very important so that we don't see violence again in the Balkans, and we should be very concerned about that given the events regarding Kosovo over the last couple of months.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Balkans again, because that's been a flashpoint in Europe going back. Well, I mean, that's how we got World War I to begin with, and before then there were a number of conflicts that were related to unrest in the Balkans, and so that's a very important part of the world, and will remain so simply because of the potential there for ethnic tension in that part of the world. Whoever the next president is, they're going to have a number of foreign policy challenges, and we've got about 45 seconds left. But if you could just maybe set the stage for what's going to happen next January when the new president takes office, what will be their primary challenge with regard to the NATO alliance?
Well, I think that really the president, whoever it is going to, you know, reach out very quickly to the European allies, try to really change the tone of the debate. And I think one of the things that will help is that all three of the candidates, have a very different position than the Bush administration on two issues of critical importance to the Europeans, and that's climate change and torture. And I think, you know, reaching out to the Europeans on those two issues, whether it's Obama, Clinton, or McCain, will really help to start set a new tone with the relations.
Thank you very much, Professor, for spending this hour with us. It's been extremely informative.
Thank you.
James M. Goldgeier, Whitney Shepherdson Senior Fellow for Transatlantic Relations at the Council on Foreign Relations and a Professor of Political Science and International Politics at George Washington University. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Griffin Higley answered the phones. If you'd like a copy of it, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program 44D, as in defense. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.